formation. He's going for the corner. He's got it. Texas is back. The kicker comes through.
We're back. Hello, welcome back from the bye week, Horns fans. This is Fire Tom Herman, your overreactionary Texas Longhorns football fan podcast. I am your host, Josh, and I'm joined, as usual, by my co-host, the one and the only, Noah. How are you doing today, man?
Hey, I'm doing pretty good. I don't know, pretty good for a Monday, since that's the day we're recording this. But yeah, I had a fun weekend, did some Oktoberfest stuff, so now it's kind of back to reality, but... How about you?
That's what I spent my weekend doing, was Oktoberfest. Had something going in town, had a little bit of beer, had some pretzels, had some brats. It was a
fun time.
Good scene for where I am, you know. With it being the bye week, we thought we'd spend a little bit of time sort of addressing things that we don't get to talk about much during the season. We spend so much time during the season focused on Texas game to game that we don't get to be really sort of college football fans at large. We don't get to talk about things that are happening outside of the Texas program or just sort of outside our frame of reference, worrying about little things with our opponent. But we don't get to talk about those major storylines. So we're just going to work our way down from the super wide open national level stuff and just make it so it's a smaller and smaller sort of frame of reference that we're looking at. So we're going to start with national storylines, talk about some Big 12 storylines, then we'll talk about some of the storylines for Texas that aren't necessarily just about what is happening game to game. And then we've got some questions. We tried to field a few questions on Twitter and on Reddit, and we'll answer some of those questions that, again, sort of address the wider reach, I guess, of college football outside of just what happens at UT. So with those national storylines, it's early in the season. We haven't had a ton of marquee games. We played in one of the only marquee games so far this year. But with the limited reference that you get with a lot of cupcake games, who is your number one team so far through September?
I don't know. I'm very unsure about this. I think I would put Ohio State. I mean, the AP is probably smart to not let either of us vote. I don't know. I usually tend to think that like the defending champion deserves to be ranked number one until somebody proves that they're better. And I don't think anybody's really proven that, but I also think that Clemson looks pretty shaky. You know, Mac Brown nearly pulled it off this last week, which would have been incredible. I'm kind of rooting for Mac. So yeah, I'd probably go with Ohio State, even though it's not like they've really beaten anybody. They did just blow the doors off Nebraska, though, and Cincinnati is a pretty solid G5. So yeah, why not? They're as good a pick as anybody else.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. I would put Ohio State up there. Like you said, with it not being a ton of great games so far, I guess you sort of have to lean that direction just because they've just been absolutely dominant. They haven't really played anybody. And like you said, Nebraska being their biggest opponent and a solid Cincinnati team, but they have absolutely throttled everyone. There's not been any hint of the sort of letdown or the slow start. It has just been blow everyone's doors off, which when you're an elite team, that's what you're supposed to do. And they have done that without much question. The problems they had on defense last year, especially in the secondary, seem to have been solved. They're not giving up big plays. They're tackling well. And then, I mean, Justin Fields looks like everything that Georgia thought they were getting. And instead, they spent their time having him hand the ball off good as fuck last year. So, and then on top of that, you have J.K. Dobbins, who I think is in that upper echelon, top five, top three probably running backs in the entire country right now, and they're just firing on all cylinders. It's hard to argue against them. It's also, like you said, without the resume, it's hard to argue for them. I think in that same group, I would put LSU, I'd put Alabama, and then from there, it starts to get blurry for me. You'd have to argue for a while, but I'm sure I could be pulled in one of several directions to round out my top four.
Yeah, honestly, I would be much more supportive of like the argument for LSU. I do think that they're a top tier team, like you're saying, but if their defense wasn't so shaky against like Vanderbilt, then I think that they would definitely be in contention for that, because I mean they have the best win of the year so far, right? Like I think we're the highest ranked one loss team, so actually Notre Dame
be up there.
Is higher than us still, but yeah, anyways, I think they're gonna be really good.
definitely. With that, sort of the next big thing, sort of that national thing, is always going to be talking about the Heisman. And it's pretty infamous at this point. Seems like every year we have someone win a September Heisman and then not end up winning it by the end of the year. Last year it was Tua, and then obviously Kyler Murray won. Where do you stand as far as the best player in the country? And this is obviously pretty hard because you have a lot of great defensive players, but it's hard to see them make the same impact that an offensive player has. So who is the best player for you? Who's most deserving of the Heisman through September?
I don't know about best player, but if I'm doing a September Heisman, I want to give it to Jonathan Taylor just because from what I've seen, he's really good. But and like Wisconsin's a run-oriented offense, so that it kind of shows that he's carrying the team and playing a bigger role than a lot of running backs do. But at the same time, even once he went down against Michigan, like he had 100 yards in the first quarter, but even after he went down, they continued to pummel Michigan. So maybe he's not making that big of a difference, but I mean, it's probably him or Jalen Hurts. Jalen Hurts has insane numbers. I think if you're doing it off numbers alone, it has to be Hurts, but I don't think those stats are sustainable. So I'll go ahead and just go with Jonathan Taylor. Give it to the running back.
Yeah, and I would kind of lean that way as well. I saw there was a tweet, I think it was ESPN put it out today, basically comparing for all the top 10 teams, the most 4-star and 5-star recruits that are now on their roster. Alabama has some absurd number, like 70 of their players are former 5 or 4-star recruits. Wisconsin doesn't even hit double digits. They have 9 recruits that were 4 or 5-star when they were being recruited. So for Jonathan Taylor to be as good as he is, as dominant as he is, every time he touches the ball, not only is he very good, especially at a place like Wisconsin that has that tradition of sort of churning out these high quality, at least college running backs. You had your Monty Ball, you had Melvin Gordon, you've got Jonathan Taylor now. And I know there's going to be people who are going to be like, oh, you're forgetting so-and-so before that. And I think that really just emphasizes the point. There's like 4 more names at least on that list of guys who have been drafted high and played sometime in the NFL after being dominant at Wisconsin. So, and at this point, I mean, it seems like you say it every time with a Wisconsin running back, that this is the best one that they've had so far. I would say it's hard to argue against him just because of the impact that he has without having just the talent around him. A guy like Jalen Hurts, you say, yeah, he's got the numbers, but you've got Lincoln Riley's system. You've got that just ridiculous wide receiver room at Oklahoma. You've got the running backs to support him. You look at Alabama and Tua, you have the same issue. The wide receiver room, especially, is just loaded. You have them to the point where they're playing rock, paper, scissors to decide who's going to run the deep route to catch the touchdown from Tua. So it's hard to judge those guys just because of the talent that's around them. And then again, with the schedules that they've played, Jalen Hurts, the toughest game they've had so far was, I don't know, maybe UCLA, maybe Texas Tech, and those are not good teams. So I would say Jonathan Taylor, just based on the schedule that Wisconsin has played and the talent surrounding him not being at that same level like you have with Jalen and Tua.
Yeah, and I think one really big selling point for him is that, like, Wisconsin's actually a legitimately good team, and I think a lot of times the thing that has stopped some of those other Wisconsin running backs from being in the conversation, and even, I mean, this includes Jonathan Taylor himself the last couple of years, or even Bryce Love, is that the teams usually aren't as good as the mega elite teams, right? But Wisconsin looks really good. So I think that if they win the Big Ten, I think he's got a really good shot, which is not very, you know, that doesn't happen very commonly.
Yeah.
Like the last time that like the best player on the best team was like a running back might have been some of those old Alabama teams. And I mean, that's how Derrick Henry and Mark Ingram won a Heisman. So I think if Wisconsin keeps it up, they could potentially, they could potentially win him a Heisman.
Yeah, as long as they don't have any hiccups. I think you could even, like we talked about how we think at this point Ohio State might be the best team in the country. Even if you go effectively, it'd be 12-2 or 11-2 because they have Ohio State in the regular season, then they face them again in the Big Ten title game. I think if you go 11-2 and your only losses are to Ohio State, I think that's high profile enough to where that could springboard Jonathan Taylor, but
yeah,
we'll have to see. That that Big Ten West is not a a juggernaut division again.
Yeah, and the issue with that, of course, will end up just being that Justin Fields might just win the Heisman if Ohio State is that good. But, I mean, I'd love for Wisconsin to win the Big Ten. I think they're a neat school. Them or Michigan, and it doesn't seem like Michigan's going to do it.
So I'm going to throw one at you here that I did not actually put in our sort of pre-planned Google Doc that we've put together for every episode.
All right, let's do it.
Do one in the positive direction, one in the negative direction. What are the biggest surprises you've seen nationally? Who's a team that's way better than you thought they'd be, and who's a team that's way worse? Mm. And even if you want to make it a little bit more open, even if it's just one part of one team, what has improved more than you thought it would, and what has gotten worse more than you expected?
Well, I'm trying to think. I think that, I mean, some of the ones are like really obvious. Like Michigan is not living up at all. SMU and Wisconsin. I guess Wisconsin, because in my mind, Wisconsin is just always the team that has a ceiling on their, and I know that we've already talked about them a little bit. You could also go with like LSU's offense, or I don't know, Ohio State or whatever. But Wisconsin just, it seems like they're always going to have that ceiling where they can be good but not great. But this year, I mean, they've looked great. So we'll see how it goes, if they can keep it up. But what would you say your positive is? I need a second to think about my...
My positive, I think it might just be the sort of desire to sort of help Texas, in my mind, just being a Texas fan. But it definitely is the LSU offense. We've heard for years, every single season, every off season, it's talk about how they're going to open up the offense, and it never goes anywhere. They keep doing the same old thing. And this year, it's absolutely 100% true. This is a modern offense, and it took Joe Burrow from looking like an average at best quarterback to being in that conversation for the September Heisman, I think. You've got Joe Brady, who came in and really in the span of 6 months took them from just absolute garbage to the best offense currently, if you're just looking at the basic, dumb, non-advanced statistics, the best offense in football right now.
Yeah, they've definitely impressed. For my negative, you know what, I'm going to go with a fan favorite answer here and go with Texas A&M, because I expected them to be 3-2, but I think that they're the team that may not be accurately represented by their records so far. But I mean, I thought they'd go like 8-4. I kind of thought they would beat Auburn. It's not a huge surprise to see them lose to Auburn, but they looked really bad against Arkansas, and it's possible that they're just not going to be very good this year. You know, they might just be like a fighting for bowl eligibility sort of team. And I didn't expect. I thought that they would be like a top 25-ish team, but they look significantly worse than that.
Yeah, that's been sort of cathartic after reading just all the hype that Texas had, how they were going to upset Clemson, upset Bama, going to give it a good shot against the LSUs and the Georgias, and really not expecting Auburn. Auburn wasn't even on their list of teams that they thought was going to be on the hit list for them. So, yeah, I like that pick. For me, I'm going to say it's surprising how bad Stanford is this year. Mm. They struggled a ton with a clearly bad Northwestern team. They nearly lost, and according to Bill Connolly's SP Plus sort of game breakdown, should have lost to Oregon State, who has been the bottom feeder of the Pac-12 for feels like a decade running now. So I would say just the step back that they've taken on in every way. I mean, they can't run the ball. KJ Costello isn't playing well when he's playing, and otherwise he's hurt. The defense isn't really there, which is something that David Shaw has basically made his reputation on. So it's just everything is going wrong all at the same time for Stanford. And I think the thing that helps David Shaw is that because it is Stanford, they're not going to overreact to this. The administration is not so concerned with athletics that they're going to yank the cord and there's going to be calls to fire him at this point. So I would say for me, it's definitely Stanford struggling in a Pac-12 that is already perceived as weak. And they were sort of expected to be one of the ones trying to carry that banner as a maybe we can make the playoff type of team. If everything goes right, we can make the playoff. I mean, not to the same level as Oregon or Washington you might have been leaning on. Okay. But well, they were sort of in that next tier.
Okay, I was going to say, I had no expectations for Stanford whatsoever before the season. Like, I expected them to be like an 8-win team. But
I mean, even if you were expecting an 8-win team, they're still far below that level.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's true. I just, yeah, I don't know. I didn't know what to think of them. Or I hadn't paid much attention to them, I guess I should just say that.
Yeah. I mean, there was enough hype, I thought, around KJ Costello and his pro prospects that I got the impression that they were expecting pretty big things, at least out of that offense anyway. And none of that has really showed up.
Yep.
For our next one for the national storyline, I guess our last question for the national storyline. Basically, as P5 fans, you kind of find yourself, you root for your P5 team, and then you kind of look at the little guys and you kind of pick out someone you're going to root for, a team you like to keep an eye on when your team's not playing, be like, oh, I'm definitely going to watch their games. I think for just about every Texas fan, everyone is kind of looking at SMU as being that team for them, especially with Shane Buechele there, especially with Rashard Samples. There's sort of that angle if you're into recruiting, and wanting to see how the wide receivers...
crushing Charlie.
Yeah, with them crushing Charlie, with them beating TCU in Fort Worth. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to root for SMU. So for that reason, we're going to eliminate them from this question. Who is your G5 darling for 2019? Who is the team that you're tuning in to watch and root for as the little guy and hope they can find their way to the New Year's Six?
Well, I guess, okay, so two teams kind of come to mind, and I haven't actually watched either of them really this season, but I guess it's two that I was pulled for. And the first one is La Tech, and I'll be completely honest, admit the only reason I care about them is because we played them this year. But they're 4-1 so far this season. So, I mean, if they end up winning like 10 games, then that's something, I guess, some sort of win. But then the other, I always root for Boise State, and it's kind of hard to call them like a G5 darling because they're always good. They're basically the best G5 program. But still, I mean, they're 4-0. And
UCF fans are in shambles.
Yeah, I don't.
I can already feel our mention blowing up for that.
Yeah, sorry UCF, but I don't know.
Don't lose to Pitt.
Yeah, Boise is just better, and they've been doing it for longer. So. Plus, like, iconic moments and all that kind of stuff. UCF is going to be known for claiming a fake national championship, where Boise State's known for the Statue of Liberty and the halfback pass and the
hook and ladder.
Yeah, and the blue field. They have a lot going for them.
I would say for me, my G5 darling this year is going to be mostly just because of where I grew up. I feel like a lot of fans find it easy to sort of pick a service academy that they like to pull for, and no one really roots against the service academies. The only time you root against a service academy is when you've already picked a side going into one of the service academy versus service academy games. But for me, I grew up in Colorado Springs, so that makes me partial to Air Force, and I think this is the best Air Force team that they've had probably in at least the last 5 years. So if I mean, this wouldn't be my pick if my CSU Rams weren't complete and utter dog shit in every phase of the game, but Air Force is my pick. Love to watch the triple option. All of the Commander-in-Chief's trophy games this year are going to be good. Air Force versus Army, Air Force versus Navy, and then obviously Army-Navy to cap it off at the end of the season. But it seems like they have the ability to make some noise. Of course, they're stuck in the Mountain Division with Boise. They already lost to Boise. But I think this is an Air Force team that can be in a position, if Boise does stumble, to sort of sneak into that Mountain West Conference championship game. And again, if UCF stumbles like they did against Pitt, they could also find their way into being the sort of the G5 representative in the New Year's Six.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move into the conference storyline. So what's going on just around the Big 12? You spent quite a bit more time than I thought we were going to on the national discussion. But let's, at this point where you're, most of us have played one conference game by the time we've recorded that. Or I think, yeah, after last weekend, everyone did. But let's reset the field. What has changed? Who is better than we thought they were? I think at this point, everyone's pretty much in agreement that OU and Texas are the two best teams in the Big 12 and seem like they're sort of set on this collision course for, obviously, we're going to run into each other in a week and a half. And then we're probably going to do it again in December. Who is the third team in the Big 12 was sort of the big question coming into the year. There's sort of this log jam. Is it going to be TCU? Is it going to be Oklahoma State? Is it going to be Iowa State with Brock Purdy coming back? And I think at this point, it seems clear to me that it's Oklahoma State by a clear margin for that number three spot.
I actually kind of think that it's Baylor. I mean, Baylor has, I think, the higher quality win between them and Oklahoma State. They're 4-0, but I don't know. I mean, Chuba Hubbard is probably the best player on either team, so who really knows? But I'd probably go with them over Oklahoma State, but that'll probably be decided once they actually play each other.
Yeah, I mean, not to say that Baylor's not good. I mean, I've got it sort of bullet-pointed here. I think Baylor's probably number four, and again, that will be sort of solidified or flipped whenever they get around to playing each other. I don't know if that's this weekend or it's not far away, I don't think.
They play 3 weeks from now. But I think there's been
3 weeks from now. See, I'm not looking at the schedule. Shows how little I actually pay attention to the schedule. Well,
I just pulled them up whenever I was kind of looking at Baylor's schedule to make sure they had played some. I mean, they beat Iowa State 23-21. And coming in the preseason, Iowa State, I thought, was pretty clearly my number three team. I wasn't very high on TCU or Baylor even. But, I mean, I wouldn't argue too hard with Oklahoma State. I think they're definitely pretty good.
Yeah, and I think Spencer Sanders has played extremely well for a redshirt freshman, especially in an offense as apparently complicated as big-brain Princeton guy Sean Gleason can apparently make him. So, and then I think they've got just the two best raw skill position players as far as Chuba Hubbard. That's still the wrong way to pronounce that. Chuba Hubbard and Tylan Wallace, I think, are the two best skill position players in the entire conference. So I think just those weapons on offense, regardless of how the defense looks. And after them watching them play Kansas State, who I thought was a pretty good offense and would give people trouble just because they are so purely pro style in a league that for so long has been dominated by the air raid and the spread, I was really impressed as far as how well Oklahoma State played on defense. And watching some of these defensive performances has just made me feel even better about our offense. Oklahoma State's defense plays well against Kansas State. For as bad as Rice is, their defense is actually pretty legit. They held Baylor scoreless in the second half of their game. So I think Rice has got a pretty legit defense. You mentioned Louisiana Tech is 4-1 this year. So it makes me feel a lot better not that we're not just getting fool's gold out of this offense that we have now. It's real.
Yeah, definitely is. All right, let's finish up the Big 12 and just ask a question that there's going to be a lot of talk about for the next 2 weeks, and that is just how good is OU?
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point, really doesn't matter who's on the schedule. Doesn't matter who the quarterback is, apparently. I mean, the offense is just going to work. As long as Lincoln Riley is in Norman, the offense will just work.
Yeah, and I mean, everybody should have known that coming into the year. Like, everybody should have known that their offense was going to be elite, because they have Lincoln Riley, and he's the best offensive mind in football.
Yeah, I think we had that discussion. I think we sort of talked about it being, like, I mean, I didn't doubt that Oklahoma was going to be elite. I was just, the way I put it is, I expect them to be elite, but not as elite as they were with the athleticism that Kyler Murray had.
Yeah.
And it's just ridiculous. See, the level of change that Lincoln Riley can put this entire offense through, to where they're featuring the QB run as heavily as they do with Jalen Hurts. Because with all of Kyler's athleticism, his athleticism was mostly just used to escape and extend plays. There weren't a lot of designed QB runs, especially in the way that they wheeled Jalen Hurts. It's just a different type of elite for them yet again. There's no surprise there.
Yeah, I don't. So basically, we know what the offense is. The defense is still kind of a question mark to me, because I remember even last year, earlier in the year, people were talking about how their defense was improved. And I don't know, at one point, I remember their run defense was like ranked as one of the best in the country after three games. But it's like they played Army, but they hadn't really played anybody yet. So we'll see if their defense can actually keep it up. I don't really think they'll be able to. They played Kansas this week, and then, of course, the Red River Showdown the week after that. But in general, I think OU's probably about the same as they were last year. Their offense might be a little bit worse once people start actually taking away the QB run as best they can, you know. But Hurts has also looked good throwing the ball.
It'll be interesting once they are hitting, once they're up against defenses that are either at least as well coached as you would get in the case of TCU or Iowa State or even Baylor this year has a pretty good defense, or defenses that have the athleticism to keep up with the athletes on their offense as you'd find with us. I think we're going to find out exactly how elite, whether or not Jalen Hurts is capable of playing the hero ball that Kyler Murray had to play last year to win several games for OU. So there's a lot to learn for them, and they're going to get six games into their schedule and have no idea, or five games in, and then game six is going to be us. Game six is going to be the first game where they're really going to be tested in any way, and that I feel like that's not the case for us. We had the LSU game. We know we can hang with that level of offense. So we're going to find out exactly how good that offense is, and especially that defense. Because at this point, yeah, you're kind of being like, OU fans sort of have to champion. Like, oh, yeah, we didn't have as many broken tackles against us, so that's better, I guess. Or you have OU fans also coming out and telling me that they have the best front seven in the conference, which I feel like is just a completely alien concept, and I feel like they don't know what they're looking for in that case. But there's still a lot for them to learn. And they really don't have anyone to learn it from except for us. This episode of the Fire Tom Herman podcast on Hornscast is sponsored by Last Stand Hats, the number one place for real Texas fans to get their game day gear. Last Stand Hats gives Texas fans the opportunity to showcase their burnt orange pride by providing apparel options outside the standard block T and Longhorn logos. If you're looking for more variety in your Longhorn gear, you have to check out laststandhats.com. And if you use the code HORNSCAST10 at checkout, you'll save 10% on your order. So make sure to wear your heart on your head and go to laststandhats.com. Hook 'em. All right, so finally here at the end, let's get into the Texas storylines. And a lot of these are sort of questions that were asked. So one of these is going to be just about the secondary. With all the injuries to the secondary, especially with Jalen Green and Caden Stearns, both starters, in addition to B.J. Foster and DeMarvion Overshown having missed time, they might be back. Seems like Foster at least will be back for West Virginia for sure. Overshown, we're going to find out here in the next day or two, so hopefully by the time you guys are listening to this, our information is completely outdated and Overshown has already been announced as playing. But how much of a beat is our secondary really losing with Green and Stearns out?
Well, I think that we're actually going to miss Jalen Green more, even though I generally think Stearns is the better player. I just don't think that Stearns has really been a difference maker really since, like, I guess consistently since like early last season, although he did have a couple really good games later in the season. But I mean, this year it's really been Chris Brown as the big star in the secondary. Montrell still filled in really well against Oklahoma State, so I think that we definitely have the depth there. And we're getting B.J. Foster back, right? You just said that. Yeah, so I mean, with Foster back, he looked really good against Georgia playing at a deep safety last year. So I'll be interested to see if they keep Brandon Jones in the nickel, if they're going to bring Foster back there. But the biggest area will probably be that cornerback spot, because now you kind of have two shaky options instead of one shaky option. So I would rather have Green and Stearns than Foster and Overshown, basically.
Yeah, I can see that. And I think part of that is, like you said, the depth that we have at safety is really a big factor there. I did want to say that I thought DeSean Jameson did pretty well against Oklahoma State for the role he played. So I'm hopeful that one of Kobe Boyce or Anthony Cook can show us enough, especially against Oklahoma, where they're really going to be challenged, enough to where we're able to sort of work around the fact that we're missing our best corner. Next question we had wasn't really much of a question, but it's talking about Oklahoma State didn't really throw that well against Kansas State, which might mean the high points of last week, our game against Oklahoma State, don't look so high in that area. However, we saw Chuba Hubbard went for, what, 296? Nearly 300 yards against the Kansas State defense that I thought was pretty solid going in. So that means our run defense is in a really good place. So, I mean, would you agree with that? Disagree with that? What do you think?
It didn't really move the meter to me that much, because I think that just watching the kind of going back and watching a little bit more in depth the Oklahoma State game is, I think, it's pretty apparent that our run defense is really good coming off of that. I hope it's going to be more consistent this year than it was last year, because last year our run defense was elite at times, and at times it got run over. although one of the teams that did the running over last year was Oklahoma State, and we just shut them down. I mean, shut down being a little bit generous, but and even the passing game, Spencer Sanders to me doesn't seem like an elite quarterback. It seems like he has a really nice arm, but he kind of, some of the balls he threw were like ill-advised prayers. Like there was one first down, he was throwing like back across his body, rolling to his right. Tylan Wallace made the catch, and they were all good throws, but it's the sort of thing where a lot of quarterbacks aren't going to take those throws, and if the defense just learns to locate the ball and play the ball, they won't be completions, right? Our defense backs really struggle with finishing plays even whenever they're in a good position. Like, I know one of those deep shots that was completed to Chris Brown, or I mean on Chris Brown, he allowed the completion. He was in a great spot. He just didn't get turned around. So I don't think it really moved the needle to me all that much. And I think that for the most part, it's just we are what we are, you know?
Definitely. Last question we got as far as just the raw Texas storylines. How does the rest of the schedule look now that we have a little bit more of an idea where teams stand in the Big 12? I would say, personally, I'm glad to have Oklahoma State out of the way. Like I said, I think they're the number three team in the conference. So I'm glad to have that off our backs, not have that sort of looming as something that could trip us up right as we're going into aiming for the conference championship game. As long as we do these things, I'm glad to have them out of the way. The Iowa State game, going to Ames, I'm never going to feel comfortable going to Ames, no matter how good we are, no matter how bad Iowa State is. I feel like that's always going to be sort of a nail biter. The game against Baylor looks better than I thought. But based on the fact that Rice was able to shut down that offense in the second half of their game, gives me a lot of hope. Charlie Brewer looks good. Denzel Mims looks good. But I feel like I saw enough out of our team in the Oklahoma State game to feel like we can shut down their one dangerous receiver and sort of make them plays without his assistance.
Yeah.
So I think those are the two games that I've really got circled. Kansas State will be interesting, but we've got that at home. And obviously the OU game is the OU game, so I'm not going to go too in-depth on that. But I think from here on out, losing anything more than the OU game would feel pretty disappointing just with how we've started and even with sort of that mid-tier quality that the rest of the Big 12 seems to be showing outside of Kansas and Texas Tech, really.
Yeah, I mean, so during the like non-conference play, the Big 12 was looking pretty good. For the last couple of weeks, I don't know, my impression is that the Big 12 is going to be a little bit easier for us to just run through outside of Oklahoma. Like, I came into this season expecting one of those like just mind-numbing losses to an inferior team. But I kind of, 5 weeks in, think that we're just going to run the table except for that OU game. So course that's really exciting in some ways, but the rest of them haven't looked, they look much more just like closely grouped together, which I generally think is not a good thing for the rest of the Big 12. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, I can understand.
But I think in terms of like actually how the schedule is for Texas, like I'd much rather have five teams that are a six than like one team that's a 7.5, you know, which is what I expected Iowa State and maybe TCU to be, but neither of those have really lived up to that. So yeah, just generally some other, a lot of average teams.
Definitely. Some of the other questions sort of finalize stuff that's not so much Texas specific and really isn't sort of current storylines, I guess, but really sort of just bigger picture college football at large, sort of the grand scheme of things. And I think I'm going to throw another one in here, another question here that we can talk about before we get into the other two that we had pre-planned. I guess the incendiary one might be, what do you think of this California bill allowing athletes to profit off their own likeness? What do you, I guess not so much, I feel like I know what your answer is going to be, so I guess I can let you clarify exactly what your answer is going to be as far as your opinion of athletes being able to profit off their likeness. But the biggest thing I think is, what is the impact that it's going to have on the NCAA? How do you see that progressing nationwide? How is the NCAA going to respond? Because it feels pretty unlikely that the NCAA is just going to sort of hand wave all of the California schools out the door. I think schools like USC are too big of tent poles in this sport for them to just say bye-bye.
Yeah, I have no idea. I mean, I support the player's ability to profit off their likeness, but I have no idea how it's going to play out. If I had to expect something, I'd expect it to, like, well, my expectation was that the bill was just going to get bogged down and, like, in the state government for, like, 2 years, and we wouldn't even hear about it much. And then, like, it'd become a big deal, like, 2 or 3 years from now. So I'm even surprised it's happening this quickly. So I have really no idea. I assume that the NCAA is just going to want to get it tied up in messy, like, legal proceedings and stuff, so it takes forever. But I have no idea how this will impact college football.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch, because I think if I read the Reddit lawyers and online opinions about it closely enough, it's going to be a couple years before it really takes effect. Like, the governor said he was going to sign it, but I think however it's set up in California, it's going to be 2 or 3 years before it even kicks in. And I'm sure the NCAA is going to fight it tooth and nail the entire way. But yeah, I think it'll be interesting. I think in the end, the NCAA is more or less going to be forced to figure out how to adapt to that. Because once California schools are paying, all the other schools in the country are going to want to be able to provide that for their athletes, allow them to profit off their likenesses. No one's going to want to be the bad guy holding that back. And I think the NCAA is going to be forced to adapt for that. But first question that we actually planned out here, coming out of the Charlie Strong era and watching him struggle now at USF and looking at other teams who are struggling with new coaches like Nebraska, what's the hindsight on how much a new coach or how much of a leash a new coach deserves to have when he starts his job?
So this is one that I actually have some pretty, like, clear thoughts on. And basically, I think that...
Let him rip, then.
Well, I think that Charlie got, like, a pretty fair shake. Like, I think that that's how most of these, like, these coaching hires should be judged. I generally think that year two... And I should say that this is for a school like Texas. If you're at a smaller school or a school like Stanford that faces, like, unique admission situations, then it's much more likely to... I think it's much better to give a coach, like, a longer leash. But from our position as a blue blood that at any given time has the talent to win 8 games in a year, you know, even in down years, I think Charlie got a fairly good, like, shake at it. And the big thing is I think that you look for improvement in year two. Because year two, like, statistically, I know there's been a lot of people talk about it. Like, Bill Connolly did a write-up that typically coaches that are successful at big programs will show improvement in year two. They don't have to win, like, a national championship or anything like that, but generally you'll see an improvement in the win-loss column in that second year if a coach is actually going to be successful. So I'm okay with giving a coach a third year because there's always context, right? And it's also hard to fire a coach after 2 years. Like, I don't think it's the right thing to do is just cut bait if somebody doesn't improve their second year. But I think that if it's year three and the coach hasn't shown improvement, then, like, that's time to move on if you can afford to do so.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And obviously, yeah, not talking about those extenuating circumstances like your service academies, like your Stanfords of the world. I think you're right. Season two, you have to show improvement, as you have to show that your culture has really taken hold. And on top of that, you have to show that your culture is trending positively. That's something that we obviously didn't get with Charlie. And I think at that point, that's where you need to make that decision, really. After 2 years at a top-level P5 program that expects to contend for conference championships and national championships on a regular basis, 2 years to see improvement while not necessarily having reached the final end goal is more than reasonable. But some of these programs, like you have for, like, Scott Frost at Nebraska, I think this year Nebraska is better than they were last year. I think there is definite improvement, especially on the offensive side of the ball, especially with Adrian Martinez. And it's easy for Nebraska fans and college football at large, and college football fans across the country, to get too wrapped up in a single game's result. Like, Nebraska's not winning their games big, necessarily. They are having to fight for every bit, but they are getting sort of that winning mentality. And then getting blown out by an elite Ohio State team really makes it seem like they're not making progress, but I think there's enough there to where even if Scott Frost wasn't sort of this treasured alumni that was super hyped about coming home, I think there would still be a lot of reasons why you would not move on from him at this point.
Yeah, and I mean, Nebraska is a blue blood, but it's probably like the most difficult blue blood to actually succeed at, especially for Frost inheriting a program that is, that wasn't hot. You know, like Ohio State and Michigan aren't in fertile recruiting grounds, but they've been good. They have like extensions.
I think you're underselling the recruiting grounds that are Ohio. Ohio actually puts out some pretty good high school football.
Sure, it's, but you can't
probably
just...
Probably would be my most underrated.
I mean, you can't just do it like Texas does, where we can sign 20 guys from Texas in a year and compete for titles. Like, I don't think it's on that level.
No, but it's definitely better than being in Nebraska.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not trying to say they're the same, but I know that Ohio State does a lot of recruiting nationally, but it's also not like Florida or some of these southern states or California. But anyways, I don't know. Yeah, so I mean, he has a little bit of a harder job. But, like, I'm looking back, I just Googled some of these coaches that actually showed that year two bump, you know? And so, like, Jim Tressel, Nick Saban, Joe Paterno, Bobby Bowden, Bob Stoops, Urban Meyer, Pete Carroll, Tommy Tuberville, Steve Spurrier. There's just so many guys that have made that year two leap. And that's also part of the reason that, like, I am such a believer in Herman now, is because he managed to do that in year two. And that's really, I think that the reason it's important is because that shows the development of players that you didn't recruit. Like, because everybody always says, oh, well, once he gets his players. But this shows you can develop players regardless of whether you're the one that recruited them, because you're just a good coach and you can coach the game.
Yeah, development and that cultural buy-in shows that it's not just about who recruited you, but these guys are actually picking up what you're putting down, basically.
Yeah.
All right, for our last question, basically, why did chaos save itself for another week, and when will it be primed to strike again? I know a lot of people were sort of hoping as far as just movement. Obviously, a lot of Texas fans were big Arkansas fans this weekend, wanting to see him upset A&M. Nearly pulled that off. But then from there, we really didn't have a whole lot for upsets. Kind of blew it up with Arizona State losing.
UNC almost pulled it off.
Yeah, UNC almost pulled it off. So we got blue balls there. And then we went into the nighttime hoping to see Nebraska maybe pull something off against Ohio State and prove that those blowouts that Ohio State had were sort of fool's gold. They didn't do any of that.
Not quite.
And then a Mississippi State game versus Auburn. Thought that would be a lot closer, and Auburn blew Mississippi State's doors off. So bad week for chaos if you're a fan of the chaos. But what do you think is going to be the next sort of step for chaos?
Well, I'm guessing that chaos is probably going to sit around, wait for us to beat OU, and then strike the week after. Whoever plays us the week after OU is probably going to be the one that the chaos gods bless, just because that's our luck, I think.
I think one team that might get put sort of through the ringer, a high-ranked team that's going to have it tough, is going to be Florida, because they've got Auburn this weekend, a game that I'll be at, by the way. Be my second game day game of the season, no big deal. Florida's got Auburn, and then they have to go, then they play LSU immediately after that, and then I think it's 2 weeks later they've got their annual game against Georgia in Jacksonville. So they've got a hell of a run right there.
Yeah,
three monster games in like 4 weeks. So I think if any team is primed for being highly ranked and to basically drop anchor and effectively be sort of the team that chaos takes out all its anger on, it's going to be Florida.
Yeah, that's pretty rough. Everybody says they haven't looked that good, so they're going to get a chance to prove us all wrong, or they're going to prove everybody right. We'll know pretty soon.
Yeah. They feel like us minus Sam Ellinger, basically. If you took Sam out and you put anyone else in, though I think Casey Thompson's got better athleticism than Kyle Trask does, I think it's that kind of step back. Otherwise, that Mullen offense is very similar to what Tom Herman has set up for us here. But there's a lot of similarities between us and Florida. And this is something that I've sort of observed going for about the last decade. We've sort of followed this same trajectory together. But yeah, very similar. Just basically our offense without the teeth of the air attack.
Yeah. And then other than that, I mean, chaos is always going to emerge once we get further into conference play. It might take a couple of weeks, but it'll happen. Like,
it always does.
I mean, nobody, there's it's never...
the most reliable force in college football.
Yeah, and like last year, I think we had Clemson, Alabama finish the year undefeated. And even I think that is kind of unusual for there to be two undefeated teams. So I think usually it's just like one, maybe two, that actually make it through unscathed. So, I mean, the target's kind of on the backs of all the... Well, I'm talking about Power 5, of course. But yeah, we'll see. We're definitely going to see some of those big, like, elite teams drop within the next couple weeks.
Well, it's good to be back after the short bye week. We will have our West Virginia preview up later this week. In the meantime, be sure to follow us on Twitter at the FTH Podcast and leave us a review on the Hornscast channels on Podbean, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you're listening to us. But until next time, hook 'em.